This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good morning, Rutherford County. It's a great morning out there. A little crispy, but it gets your blood going. And had Mr. Greg Tucker on, my good friend Greg. And
it was just plain cold at 7 a.m. this morning.
Yes, it was. I went out to get my paper at 7 o'clock this morning, dodging all the school traffic, but I made it across. You and I had a different day yesterday. We lost a good friend, Dr. Leon Ruland, and they had the service yesterday, and it was one of the nicest services I think I've ever attended.
The representation of, I guess, every law enforcement division in the state and several of the local divisions was very impressive.
I was very impressed with Murfreesboro Police Department and the Highway Patrol, the way they conducted the formal ceremonies, both at the church and at the graveside.
Yeah, the honor guard.
Yes.
And
there's something about a law enforcement officer that we lose, and when they do the ceremony for them, and at the very last, they do the dispatch. And then they call out his name and his number, and they put him 10-7. And that just absolutely just does me in. It will every time. It's like when you play taps at a soldier's funeral.
You want to explain for your listeners 10-7?
10-7 is the law enforcement code for being out of service. So it's a special time. And we had yesterday, we had on the Trail of Tears people, the Native American History Association, and we were talking about the Trail of Tears, and we forgot to mention that they're having a tour this coming Saturday, and it's going to be at 10 a.m., and it'll be at the East Fork Recreation Area. And that's the Trail of Tears, and they're going to have trail riders, they're going to have horseback riding, and then they're going to have the people who will have the walking tour. And that's this coming Saturday, East Fork Recreation Area at 10 a.m. And we want to mention also this coming Saturday, they're having an absolute auction, and that's Sims Auctioneer Company, and it's going to be at 10:30 a.m. That's 10:30 a.m. this coming Saturday at 3376 Craner Road. That's 3376 Craner Road. And they have three tracks for sale, and they're beautiful tracks. Track one is 1,648 square foot house, three bedrooms, two full baths, and it's on 3.88 acres, and it does have a perk site there. Track two is 5.37 acres or 233,916 square footage with perk site, and track 3, 5.21 acres on 222,947 square foot with perk site. And you can find out more information by emailing Larry Sims. That's Larry@LarrySims.com, Larry@LarrySims.com, and you can view auction pictures and visit www.LarrySims.com. That's www.LarrySims.com. And actually, it has the river running next to it, Greg, and that's where I learned how to swim, in that river there.
You had formal swimming lessons in the river?
I had very formal swimming lessons. My grandfather taught me how to swim in one quick action, and still remember it to this day.
It's called the shock treatment, I think.
Yes. I learned a lot from my granddaddy. I really did. He was a very special person. Well, I read your article Sunday in that newspaper, and very well done. In fact, I think it's one of your best articles. And maybe because it I have so many fond remembrance of the Carnation Milk Company.
This has been the pattern that I enjoy, that when I write about something where people remember either that they were there or their father or their grandfather, and mm-hmm. I've had several emails and several people have stopped me and commented, and one, for example, told me about his grandfather, who was the actual first general manager over there at the plant when it opened up in 1927. Wow. And this is one way that I'm able to add to what I have written in the paper for the book. So when the next book comes out, I'll be able to elaborate on several points. And I did get one little bit of concern call. We made reference to the old building that came off the Lytle Plantation, which Carnation essentially gave to Oaklands and was moved. I said it's rarely used. I still think it's rarely used, but it is used occasionally for some of the educational programs over there at Oaklands, and such as demonstrations of old crafts, skills, and that kind of thing.
Now, where is it? What's the location?
If you go in the driveway towards the Oaklands Mansion, over to the right is a small brick building, which is rather...
Which one are you talking about now?
Yeah, and you go by there right now, it's locked and closed. It's not part of the regular tour activity over at Oakland. At one time, it was a medical museum. Dr. James Maney, the first master of Oaklands that built Oaklands originally, was a doctor. But for many years, the building has sat idle. And they are beginning to make some use of it now for some of their educational programs. But I'd like to see it made more a part of the Oaklands experience, so every tourist that comes by can have an opportunity to see what a very solid brick building from that early 1800s amounts to. Interesting, too, the building had been painted, I think, white by Carnation or somebody. All the Carnation buildings are white. Maybe that's because of the milk color. I don't know.
So
if you spill the milk, it wasn't as obvious. And when they dismantled the little brick building and rebuilt it, they turned the brick inside out.
Oh.
So the natural side of the brick shows and not the old painted part, but it would still have the same look.
You know, it was so interesting reading your article as to why they selected this particular area to bring their company in. And I didn't, I guess maybe I had forgotten, but after I read your article, I did remember that most of our milk cows back when I was a young kid were Jerseys. You didn't see many or any Holsteins around here.
Now, that's an interesting point, because when you read the history of Carnation, they favored the Holstein and, in fact, were very much involved in the selective breeding to improve the Holstein breed and such. Yeah, when they came here, they used the Jerseys. The Jersey had a higher butterfat content, which meant for cheese, butter, over at the creamery was ideal. But for the process involved, apparently, in condensing or evaporating milk, you needed a lower butter fat. But they used what was here. And I guess they used it in part because it was so abundant. I mean, that was our industry during that period, dairy industry, milking. Over time, as you know, the Holsteins began to come in. And I've heard some different opinion as to whether it was right after the war we began to see the Holsteins or on later in the 50s, but clearly by the 60s the Holsteins were the dominant breed here, and perhaps Carnation influenced that, but Carnation shut down in the early 70s, so most of the time that they were here they were relying on those Jersey herds for the milk.
Did we have any data on why they decided to close down? Because if I remember right, that's a very successful plant over here.
No, that's something I'd enjoy trying to learn more about. It may be the shifting population patterns. It may have been some change in Carnation itself. You know who now owns Carnation? There's still a Carnation brand, but it's owned by a foreign company.
Oh, naturally.
Nestle. Nestle now owns Carnation. In fact, if you go to the store and pick up a Carnation can, it has a Nestle label kind of over the familiar Carnation red.
But well, you just threw me, because I thought Nestle was located somewhere in the Northeast.
Well, Hershey, Nestle's big rival back in the chocolate wars.
That's in Pennsylvania.
He's in Pennsylvania, but no, Nestle is a European company.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And, of course, Hershey and Nestle have now bought and absorbed so many of the old candy companies, chocolate companies, and milk companies that both of them are now big conglomerates. But
well, we're wondering where all our jobs are. They're not here anymore, are they? All across the world. Aren't we nice to let them have all of our jobs?
Well, they also own an awful lot of our real estate.
Yeah.
They took over the plants and all that were here. So it could have been a reorganization that closed that plant, our plant here. And also, I think evaporated milk, the market for evaporated milk has declined. You remember how common it was when we were young.
Yes.
I imagine I could look in a bunch of refrigerators around Murfreesboro and you wouldn't find it these days. The sweetened condensed milk, which is a product of a product, is still popular in certain cooking. But the evaporated milk, you don't see much anymore. Babies don't. You know, that used to be the formula. Mm-hmm. If you had to supplement a nursing baby, you used the evaporated milk. But
well, now, you're much more of a farmer than... Well, I was a farmer when I was young, but you know more about how that business works. Was that when we started, our farms started dwindling down as far as our dairy farms at that time when they left? And I remember some of the biggest dairy farms or the ones that had probably the most cows were people like Myers Parson and some of those. And in fact, I believe in reading your article that he was one of those that switched to Holsteins.
Well, Myers began brokering cattle. Mm-hmm. He was teaching the ag courses and bringing, I think he told me he started bringing them in because his students, as projects, would raise a calf. Mm-hmm. And through those contacts, he became a very significant, in this area, cattle broker. Mm-hmm. And he tells a story that... maybe have you had him on as he told his story about Castro and the cows?
You know, he has been on my show. It's been some time, but I don't believe we talked about Castro.
Well, you need to bring him back because he's got a good story about selling cattle to Castro in the early days of the Castro regime before it was obvious what was going on down there and how they got tied up in politics and such, and how I think they eventually got to fly. But that's his story. We'll let him tell that.
For the life of me, I can't imagine dairy farms being in Cuba. I don't believe, it's kind of like mixing Batista and Castro together.
They're better known for a stronger drink down there.
Castro was a pretty good baseball player, they say.
I've heard that.
In fact, in Cuban lore, if he had made one of the major league teams,
he wouldn't have been the rebel, huh?
He wouldn't have been the rebel. Probably had a whole lot more money at the end, too.
Yeah, right. That's true.
Well, now, when the Carnation Milk Company was talking about coming here, there was a lot of pros and a lot of cons with them coming in. By reading your article, it wasn't exactly welcomed in with open arms with some people.
Right.
But others, it was, simply because of the jobs, of course.
Well, once everything was clear that it was coming, there was, of course, a big, big celebration, probably equal to what we saw back in the 1850s when the railroad first hit here. I have a picture of a barbecue which was not of the quality that you can really reproduce it in the newspaper. But they dug 4 or 5 trenches, looked like each one of them was about 50 feet long. Burned bonfires for 24 or 48 hours to get enough hot coals, and then must have killed every goat in sight for the big barbecue to welcome Carnation. The stumbling block that tied it up for a while was Captain Lytle's son, who died in 1862, apparently wanted to I guess he wanted to take care of subsequent generations, mm-hmm. but he also looked like he was just trying to tie the property up. Because instead of leaving it to one or the other or dividing it up, he set up three generations of life estates. I'm not even sure the courts would let that go today, but he set it up so that, you know, my children, and their children all mm-hmm. had life estates, which means it couldn't be sold, mm-hmm. that somebody had a life estate. So when Carnation apparently stubbornly determined that that was the place, the best place, and of course it was an ideal location next to the railroad, right at the where two major highways came mm-hmm. together and so forth. It ended up in court, and the first thing that was kind of amusing is the chancellor in the chancery court, who was supposed to hear it, was Thomas Lytle.
And he had to recuse himself.
He had to step aside, and they brought in Chancellor Stewart from another division. And he did a good job of figuring it out. He just took the money that Carnation was going to pay and put that in to fund the life estates until they ran out. But you had over 100 descendants of the Lytles by that time, all of whom had at least a minor stake in it. So it took a while to sort it out.
And it wasn't a whole lot of money by today's standards.
Oh, by today's standards, no. Can you imagine buying? I think they bought 40 acres for $15,000.
Yeah.
But it was serious money back then. And at they recite in the legal record that the trustee was able to get 5% return a year. Mm-hmm. And that 5% was significant support for two of the elderly descendants, who were still entitled to the life estate.
Now, being an attorney, you have seen probably that a number of times. I know there have been cases here other than that particular case where the land was tied up through three or four generations at least, and then something would come along that the government needed for transportation or whatever, roads
right,
and those type
right.
things. And they come in and they kind of supersede that. How does that work?
Well, in order for things to get done, the chancery mm-hmm. courts have the authority to give title and to give clear title. But, of course, our due process requirements, everybody that might have a claim, mm-hmm. the way you see it is frequently property that has been in a family for many generations, mm-hmm. and the family just without... giving a whole lot of attention to it, just lets, you know, one or another, say the youngest child stays on the property, and, mm-hmm. and it just keeps passing informally. And then either someone comes along to buy it, or the government, the local government, needs it for a public development of some kind. And you'll have 15, 20 claimants. And what the Chancery Court does is round them all up mm-hmm. and give a time frame for self-identity, and there are rules of how much notice has to be given. And once the court says, okay, everybody's had a chance to be here and everybody's had a chance to put in their claim, here's how we're going to resolve it, and, you know, can clear it up. And that keeps us from having property that is essentially unproductive. And that's what happened here. The court essentially dismissed all the 100 Lytle claimants, mm-hmm. but gave them a chance to be heard, left it in the life estate. And then, you know, when the two remaining individuals entitled to the life estate died, then it all went back together. And there still remained over 200 acres of the Lytle property, which was productive. It was leased out to various farmers, mm-hmm. and it was this corner of about 40 acres that hadn't been used. The house was sitting on it. Now, I mentioned in my article that the house sits on the footprint. Not quite. I actually have a picture now. The house was still standing as they built the Carnation plant, and the Carnation plant is squeezed right up behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it encroaches on the footprint of the house, but apparently the house was torn down after the plant was either built or was in the process of being built. So, but it's interesting. I've got a picture that we'll use somewhere now that was given to me by one of the people responding to the article that shows the old Lytle mansion, and right behind it, tight up against it, is the new carnation plant.
I wish you brought that with you.
Well, it's hard to show on the radio, but it's an interesting picture.
You know, I guess we need, there's probably people here that don't even never heard of the carnation milk plant here, and they don't know exactly where it is. And I have seen it described by people who are not from here, who were fussing because why that piece of property is still there. You might want to let them know where it is.
Well, we all see the smokestack as you go across the bridge over the railroad, the smokestack right just to the right there. But there's more than a smokestack there. It's on the back of the Haynes Brothers lumber yard now, mm-hmm. but it looks to me like almost the entire plant is still standing. Parts of it may be down, mm-hmm. but at the base of that smokestack is a substantial building still, and it's painted white.
This is your show, aren't you going to say?
We're going to take a break now? Is that what we're doing?
Hey, it's your show, big boy.
All right, I think we're going to take a break so Truman can bring in a little cash.
The Outpost Armory is not just another gun store. Our staff has hands-on knowledge and experience with firearms, self-defense training, hunting, and competitive shooting. We cater to the new gun owner and the expert looking for that hard-to-find product. We carry items that the big chain stores don't and have bulk ammunition for the high-volume shooter. We defend the Second Amendment and help responsible citizens protect their families, rights, and liberties. Visit us in person or online at theoutpostarmory.com. The Outpost Armory, I-24 East at Exit 89 in Murfreesboro.
Start your mornings with WGNS. Weekday mornings at 9, The Truman Show. Rutherford Issues with Brian Barrett. Weekday mornings at 10 on the stations of WGNS.
Tennessee Radio Network News. I'm Jim Williams. Tennessee is still the worst off among the 9 states where rare fungal meningitis has been killing people the last few weeks after steroid injections for back pain. 105 people have been sickened nationwide, according to State Public Health Director John Dreisner.
There's a big difference between people who are not symptomatic and people that do have symptoms in terms of how we do appropriate diagnosis and treatment.
Dreisner says a Centerville woman who died over the weekend is the 5th death from the illness in the volunteer state. He and other health officials are reviewing the situation. The health commissioner says one death back on the 26th of last month didn't get reported till this past weekend. Also, neighboring Kentucky has several people sick with the disease, but all of them got it after treatments here. The first death was a judge from that state. A revised court filing shows the Shelby County Commission might refuse to provide money to those 6 new suburban school districts unless a judge requires it. The amended complaint filed in federal court says the commission will take whatever steps are necessary to avoid funding resegregation of the local public schools. Chairman Mike Ritz says commission lawyers will seek direction from federal judge Samuel Hardy Mays, who is expected to rule soon as to whether the new local school systems approved by a half dozen Memphis suburban cities in the primary are legal.
Welcome to Let's Talk Titans. I'm Blaine Bishop, and this is the newest addition to the team, Ralph Henderson. Good to see you.
Blaine, it's good to be seen. And good that we finally met. You know, intersecting careers and all.
Now, you've just won the Tennessee Titans lottery game to become the 12th Titan, right?
That is correct. And I've already got some new plays drawn up. Got your playbook on ya?
Nah, they make you turn that in.
That's okay. I can walk you through most of this stuff.
Didn't know designing plays was part of being the 12th Titan.
Blaine, baby. Number 12 doesn't give 110%, he gives 112%.
Play the Titans instant game from the Tennessee Lottery. Win $100,000 or become the team's most famous fan, the 12th Titan, with game day duties like retrieving the kickoff tee and more.
Ralph, all these plays have you going both ways. Nobody does that.
The game's changing, Blaine. The game's changing every day.
The new Titans instant game, only from the Tennessee Lottery. Game-changing fun.
Bag the deer of a lifetime, you have to be prepared. That's why you need to shop Murfreesboro Outdoors.
This is Randy at Murfreesboro Outdoors. We get camouflage clothes, shotguns, shells.
Murfreesboro Outdoors on Northwest Broad Street.
White County authorities have urged residents to check their wallets for counterfeit cash. That warning comes after a fake 20 showed up at a business in Sparta. The sheriff's office believes more counterfeits could be circulating. A fast-moving overnight fire destroyed Ivy Bluff United Methodist Church in rural Cannon County. That building reduced to ashes except a few broken brick walls. And in sports, Titans head coach Mike Munchak has announced Matt Hasselbeck will make his second straight start at quarterback when the team hosts the Steelers Thursday night. Jim Williams, Tennessee Radio Network News.
Next is the Better Business Focus with Terry Page.
Have low interest rates and ongoing market volatility jeopardized your financial peace of mind? There is a solution. Work with a professional that believes in safe money alternatives. For 24 years, Doug King of King Financial Management specialized in strategies that provide asset protection, moderate growth, and guaranteed retirement income. Call Doug today at 877-890-5489 so that tomorrow your money will be working smarter for you. Online at kingfinancialmanagement.com. That's kingfinancialmanagement.com.
Quality products, outstanding service, friendly employees, all are essential to a successful business. But there are also invisible products every business must have, like honesty, dependability, and customer trust. Customer loyalty is earned when businesses take the time to learn from their customers. Our BBB accredited businesses make this pledge. This is Terry Page with your local Better Business Bureau.
Would you like to know what 4-H has to offer your child? Rutherford County has more than 4,000 4-H members, and they need your help. Support the 4-H fundraiser on Thursday, October the 11th. 4-H is public speaking, camp, and so much more. The 4-H barbecue auction at the Lane Agri Park Community Center on Thursday, October the 11th. Tickets are on sale at the Extension office. A silent and live auction are also part of the night's festivities. Call 898-7710 for more information. Support 4-H at our barbecue dinner and auction on Thursday, October the 11th.
Attention brides and grooms. Getting married?
Have you made all of your wedding plans?
Plan your wedding in one day by attending the Murfreesboro Pink Bridal Show this Sunday.
Noon until 4 p.m. at the Embassy Suites here in Murfreesboro.
Meet with wedding professionals who will help you with all of your wedding needs.
Caterers, photographers, videographers, florists, cakes, and much more. Visit thepinkbride.com for more information.
Tickets available online or at the door.
The Murfreesboro Pink Bridal Show.
At the Embassy Suites.
This Sunday.
Weather Eye.
For the forecast area today, plenty of sunshine, highs in the upper 60s, with a south-southwest wind around 5. Tonight we have a slight chance for developing shower. I'm WGNS meteorologist Mandy Thaluber.
Right now it is 48.
Today's WGNS birthday cake winner, Charlie Farless. Happy birthday to Charlie, receiving the birthday cake from Junior's Foodland. Our good neighbors of the day, Chris and Sharon Jones on Dodd Trail. They receive flowers from Ryan's Flowers and Gifts.
That update brought to you by Safe Auto. You had an accident and the guy's bloodthirsty lawyer wants to sue you. How would you protect yourself? You call 1-800-SAFE-AUTO for affordable liability insurance. Drive safe, spend less. Safe Auto.
He knows Rutherford County as good as anybody. Truman Jones. It's the Truman Show here on WGNS AM and FM.
I'm not sure where we are right now. We have a tech guy over here, Brian Barrett, who keeps everything disturbed, and I don't even know what subject we were on.
And he's telling tall tales now about how we get our weather reports from Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Yeah. We're in the 13th month of our Murfreesboro Bicentennial. This is the last month of our formal Bicentennial celebration.
I thought there were only 12 months in a year.
Well, the mayor, I thought, made a smart move and decided to...
The mayor always makes smart moves.
Yeah, instead of having one big party, they have a whole bunch of parties.
I believe we have a caller on the line, Greg. Caller, welcome aboard with Greg Tucker.
I don't hear anything.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Hello, Truman and Greg.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, this is Ken, the guy that y'all would know as the harmonica player from Reedville Mill.
Hey, Ken, how are you?
I'm fine.
But how's Miss Sarah this morning?
That's not why I called in. I just wanted to want you to recognize me. But
Ken Frizzell.
Greg, yeah. That the first public job I ever had at 17 years old was working at the Carnation Milk Plant.
I don't know what's going on. There's music in the background. What was your job over there, Ken?
We were packing up and sending carnation milk out to the military.
Oh.
And my particular job was putting a sleeve on the boxes to reinforce them so they could stand the trip to wherever they were going. And I worked there during the time that I was waiting to be called into the Navy. I had joined the Navy in June of 45, the month that Germany surrendered. I was sworn in August, the month that Japan surrendered, so you can give me credit for stopping World War II.
That worked out just right. Well, you know, coincidentally, I got an email from a fellow, I believe it was James Parks, who recalls hearing stories about the National Guard unit that went from Murfreesboro overseas. And when they opened their supplies overseas, they found a whole bunch of Carnation milk cans from Murfreesboro.
Wow.
He said they were, you know,
just like
being close to home. So maybe those are the cans you packed and sent over there.
But anyway, I went on and worked there till September, and then the Navy called me on into service. I went ahead and served my military time and got out and met my sweet wife, Sarah, which y'all know too.
Yes.
And shortly thereafter, I did own some milk cows and did sell some milk to Carnation Company.
What color were your cows?
Pardon me?
What color were the cows?
They were jerseys.
You had jerseys, okay.
But I've still got 2 10-gallon milk cans that I sold milk to Carnation in.
Well, hold on to them.
I'll tell you all that little bit about my history.
Well, good. Thank you for calling me,
Ken. And while I was working there, I lived 4 miles out on Manchester Highway where my daddy was running a dairy farm for Jennings Jones.
Did you walk to work?
I rode a bicycle.
No, you rode a bicycle.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. That's right down from me, Ken.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, it is. It is, Truman.
I tell you what, before you get off, I want to let you know that you guys did a great job over at the mill last week. I mean, it's some of the best music that I've heard, and the setting was just absolutely beautiful that night.
Well, we were pleased with it, and I thank you for commenting on it.
Well, let's do it again.
The CD is a good CD. I don't know if you've had a chance to listen.
Yeah, I've played the CD all the way through a couple of times.
Yeah, okay.
What is it? John B. and the Balladeers, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and I guess you can buy it at the mill.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Just want to say hello to both of you guys.
Thank you, Ken.
Look forward to seeing you again.
You too.
Okay.
Tell Sarah, hey.
I will.
Bye. Well, we were about to say that 200 years ago this month, there still was no Murfreesboro, but the four forgotten founders had begun the process of clearing the land, and a few of the new landowners were beginning to build. What's interesting, though, is that the Jefferson interest still controlled the county legislature called the Quarterly Court, and they refused to meet in Murfreesboro. Mm. They insisted on continuing to meet in Jefferson. It wasn't until January of the next year that they finally got a majority in the Quarterly Court, and they convened in Jefferson, the Murfreesboro interest. They convened in Jefferson and immediately moved to adjourn and to reconvene in the Murfreesboro area. So we're still about 4 months from actually having the county seat down here in Murfreesboro. And it's also interesting that the founders still controlled the government of the area, and they controlled all the money.
Mm-hmm.
But as people began to move into Murfreesboro and build and settle in Murfreesboro, they began to chafe a little bit at this four fellows who really weren't in Murfreesboro. Had interest elsewhere, but they still control the money. So they went back to the legislature and essentially got these guys fired in 1815. And still it was 1817 before we got the city incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, the 150th anniversary was based on the date of incorporation. So although we're winding up our bicentennial celebration, and you and I won't have to talk about it every month now, we're still a good ways away from the 200th anniversary of the actual organization of the city.
You know, the city does a good job in keeping history alive and looking toward the future. Tommy Bragg has done such a tremendous job over there, and he has so many good people that work with him. And I went through the number of people that were selected for specific areas of our history, and I was so amazed and proud of every one of them that got up and relayed what our history was for those who were experts in certain areas, and of course you're our number one expert in the history of this area.
Well, John Hood did an excellent job of chairing and kind of leading discussions each month.
Well, he remembers most people of the history himself.
He goes a lot further. He's older than he looks, you know. He really is.
He really is a lot older than he looks.
I was pleased with that exercise because it was documented. And now there is, for those maybe another 50 years from now who want to look back, there's a good documented record, visual as well as oral, with a lot of good history in it. So if nothing else, we've made a good record over this last year.
There's a lot of history out there that still hasn't been brought to the forefront. And there are numbers that people can call if they want to share some of that hasn't been recorded yet. And, you know, when I had the Trail of Tears, the Native American Association on yesterday, it's kind of sad to know that a large part of their history is gone forever, because theirs was basically passed down from generation to generation and wasn't written. And that's, you know, when that type of history is gone, you know, it's pretty much gone forever. So people need to share their knowledge so that we can keep it alive here in the community.
Yeah, I listened yesterday. I enjoyed that very much. And in particular, and I think you specifically asked the question, was what was the route they followed and what happened in Rutherford County, our own area. And it is interesting that the main group came through Mike Mendeville on through the Woodbury area. And of course, Cannon County had just been organized about the time they were coming through in the 1830s. And then, according to what we heard yesterday, the main movement group split and went on two different routes through Murfreesboro. And I was curious, and I look forward to talking with them again, just what the sources were. Perhaps there are military records they were relying on, because the military, although in a limited way, but the military escorted the march of the Indians, the walk. There it really was. There was some suggestion, though, that perhaps the toll roads had something to do with it. Mm-hmm. Well, we've written about the toll roads. The first toll road in Rutherford County was authorized by the state legislature in 1831. The work actually started on it in 1832, and that was from Nashville to Murfreesboro. The toll road that went from Murfreesboro to Readaville was not authorized until 1842, so there would not have been a toll road between Murfreesboro and Readaville in the 1830s. There was a road, though, and interesting that what they described as the northern branch that went followed the original public road through this area, which went from Nashville to McMinnville, through Jefferson, through Readaville. And I can see them following that, and there were no toll roads legally at that time on that route. You wonder, though, because a lot of that route was controlled by private property owners. Mm-hmm. Well, that some were just on their own charging tolls. That's possible. But the first toll roads didn't open. Well, the one that was begun in 1832, of course, they started building it up at Nashville. It took them 10 years to complete it, so it really wasn't open all the way to Murfreesboro until 1842. It's interesting that little bit of toll road in the state of Tennessee immediately created such a hassle because of the arguments over how it should be built, how it should be managed, what should be charged, that before they licensed another one, they came out with, the state legislature came out with the rules so that from there forward they were all done the same way, managed the same way, charged the same rates. They even set the rates that could be charged and how often they could be charged. But that bit that came into Rutherford County was one of the very first in the state, and the one that demonstrated the need for some standardization.
Now, the toll roads at that time, were they private toll roads and for their own particular needs? Because a lot of times toll roads are set up to actually pay for the roads themselves.
Well, today they're all done by some government authority or an organization chartered by the government. Back then they were given franchises. And it's interesting when you read who got the franchises through Rutherford County, you see some very familiar names come up over and over. Spence, for instance, must have been party to a half dozen different toll roads around the area. A businessman, an entrepreneur, saw the opportunity to make money, and they did. They were very profitable for a while. By the 1900s, though, they weren't able to really maintain them, and that's when the states and the counties started taking over.
Well, the question, of course, that I would have, and you think back on it, are these state roads that are built by the state but actually run through somebody's property, and because they run through that individual's property, he sets up a toll? Because for this day and time, it doesn't make sense to me.
No.
It really doesn't.
Well, you know, even back then, if you read the authorization that would be given to the private group, usually, of the company, they gave them what today we would call the right of condemnation. They had the authority to go to, once their route was approved, and there was state oversight approving the route, once their route was approved, the individual who had the franchise would go to the property owners and say, the road's coming through here, and here's, you know, my offer to you for your land, and they would negotiate sale of the land. If they refused, then they had the right to take the land, just as, you know, the government does now.
Are they responsible for the upkeep of the road?
Once the and that's interesting. If I'm the franchisor or franchisee, I've got the right to build that toll road, say, over the side of your property, and I need rock, and I need rock off your place. I also had the authority to take the rock if you wouldn't sell it and negotiate. And again, fair compensation, but that would be determined by the court. So these private entities had an awful lot of authority because the state wanted the roads built. And when they selected somebody to build them, they gave them the authority to get the road built. And then, you know, a 50-year franchise to collect tolls or whatever it might be. We talked a little bit about streets in Murfreesboro, remind me, last week. And I got a call from J.O. Gist because we mentioned...
J.O.
Yeah, we mentioned... J.O. heard us mention McKnight, and he called to see which McKnight there was. That street in particular was named for Mayor McKnight, Al D. McKnight, who was mayor from about 1925 to 1931. And that's J.O.'s wife's father, I believe, is what he told me.
Wow.
Maybe the uncle, but one of his family. So he was interested in that naming. As I said last time we were on, I've not really focused on researching those names, but you come across things that are interesting about the names of the streets. When they first laid out the pattern for the city, the extreme street to the east was called East Street.
Makes sense.
And the extreme street to the west was called West Street. They're now respectively Academy and Front Street. The extreme street to the north was called High Street. Now, I can imagine, I don't know for certain, but I imagine it was the highest going north on the map, was High Street. The one that's a mystery to me, I have not seen anything indicating, was Vine Street, because that was the street to the south. And whether it was originally Vine Street or something else, I've not been able to determine. But interesting. Academy, the West Street, the West Street became Front Street again because of the commercial activity, I believe. It fronted on the creek, which was at that time a transportation route. East Street, which became Academy, was not because of the Bradley Academy that we know today, but the original move of Bradley Academy to Murfreesboro, the second location of the Academy, was about the corner where the Episcopal Church is now. And that was brought here in 1814, so that street name changed quickly. It's interesting, too, that there is a city action to make that Bradley spot lot number 71. Remember, there were 70 lots when they originally laid out the city. And there is a documentation that they decided to make the Bradley Academy site there on East Main, lot number 71. But the academy failed and disappeared for several years. The headmaster, Black, went back to Jefferson. And so they, and interestingly enough, the academy didn't own the property, but was essentially using loaned property from a private individual, probably one of the Murphys. And so they abandoned that as lot number 71. And then when Lytle did his subdivision, he started with 71 and numbered on from that.
Was there any documentation back years ago to determine why a street was named for an individual?
It should be in the, if it's in the city, it should be in the minutes of the alderman meetings and such, which I don't think are available, are still in existence for a lot of the 1800s. If they are, I've not had access to them yet. There would be a lot of questions I'd like to see answered from that. If they're county roads, the county road board, and I know now you could find records of, you know, the last several generations. But again, I don't know how far back those go. And some of them you can kind of figure out. For instance, there's a Jackson Street. Now, who do you think that would be named for?
I'm sure it's not Andrew Jackson.
Right. It's not Andrew. If you look at the other streets around it, it's Forrest, Lee, and Jackson. So I expect that Stonewall Jackson, because that little part of the town was being developed in the aftermath of the Civil War. So our heroes, Stonewall Jackson and Lee and Forrest over in that area. One that's intriguing is Depot Street.
I guess that's over at the railroad track, right?
Well, actually, it's now called Maple Street. And Maple Street, before the big urban renewal in the 50s, extended all the way to Depot Hill. If you head south on Church Street from Broad, you go up a fairly, you don't notice it, because today we got gasoline powering us up the hill. But there's a pretty steep hill as you start up south on Church Street.
You're not supposed to go over 40 miles an hour going up that hill.
Something like that.
Pretty hard to go 40 miles an hour going up that hill.
But that's Depot Hill. And again, that predates the railroad coming through here. So my, again, just trying to figure it out, that probably was a wagon depot.
When was our depot first built here?
Well, the railroad hit here in about 1848 to 1850. And originally it was more towards Depot Hill, but the street was named Depot Street before that time. I can't tell you exactly where, but there were terminals several places. For instance, there was a loading terminal on down the track towards Fosterville, right behind what we call Tiger Hill.
Let me mention that this part of Greg Tucker's show is brought to you by Murfreesboro Automotive. And when you need car repairs, you want someone you can trust. Murfreesboro Automotive is that place. Chuck Haynes has a staff of certified technicians that can fix anything. From a simple oil change to major auto repair, Murfreesboro Automotive is the only place you need. Murfreesboro Automotive, turn off Broad between Chewy's and Chili's on to Ridgely Road. I'm sorry. Fire on.
Got to pay the bill. High Street, as it was originally named, is now College Street. And if you look at the old layouts of the city, College Street runs right into what used to be the front door of Union University. So I assume that it was changed from High Street to College Street in the 1840s when Union was first being built there. But it's interesting to try to trace the names, how they've changed. Another one. We've talked about Capitol Hill over here, which is right across the street from the Bradley Academy building that's still there. And about half the hill has been cut out for the shopping center below. The streets around that are called Sevier Street, our first governor, and State Street. And I think we've talked before how Mr. Hilliard was trying to get the state to put the state capitol there. Mm-hmm. So he went ahead and named the streets as though they were going to be around the state capitol.
What's he doing, Greg? It's your show.
He's holding up a sign that says, take a break. I thought you just did that.
I did, but I guess we'll take another one. Take a break.
It's time. Blue Raiders.
Support your Blue Raiders as they compete for back-to-back Sun Belt Conference titles. Men's and women's basketball combo season tickets are on sale now and start as low as $199. Don't miss a single three-pointer. Score a slam dunk with season tickets today.
Show your true blue. Support your Blue Raiders. Tickets available at GoBlueRaiders.com or call 1-888-YES-MTSU. Go Blue Raiders.
We're talking with Dr. Rishi Saxena, this area's only certified physician in heart CT, about the 64-slice CT scan.
Before you go for heart catheterization because of pain or minor abnormality in stress test, you need to consider this non-invasive device to find out about the blockage. Or if you just have risk factor, you're not having any chest pain, you want to find out flag early so you could act on it.
No needles, no pain, it only takes minutes. Call 896-4800. Dr. Rishi Saxena.
Roscoe Brown. For 70 years, we've had one goal, to give you the very best in home comfort and value. The same way of thinking lives on today with Roscoe's son and grandson, and why we say there's a little bit of Roscoe in every job we do. Turn to the experts at Roscoe Brown for an energy-efficient carrier system with rebates, tax credits, and monthly payments as low as $199. Call 888-MY-ROSCOE.
Your friend since 1940, Roscoe Brown is who you trust.
You can depend on Claiborne and Taylor.
For decades, Farmer Brothers Insurance and the Murfreesboro Insurance Agency have been serving our neighbors. Now they have joined forces because sometimes more is more. Claiborne and Taylor is one of Murfreesboro's largest locally owned independent agencies. More options and more personal attention. Drop in for their open house on Friday, October the 12th, just behind Tire World on Memorial Boulevard. Visit ClaiborneTaylor.com for more information.
Live with breaking news. Breaking news. This is Talk Radio WGNS.
Handed down moments ago, the sentence for former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky. Let's go live to Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. ABC's Aaron Kutursky. Aaron?
In a red smock and trousers, Jerry Sandusky learned he would be spending the rest of his life in prison. He looked on as prosecutors called him an India's depraved criminal, and the charity he founded, prosecutors called a victim factory. Doug, the defense said there is another side to Sandusky, a generous, kind, and giving side. Sandusky himself was unapologetic to the end. He told the judge, "I didn't do these disgusting acts," but the judge called Sandusky dangerous and sentenced him to no less than 30 years in prison, making him 98 before he's eligible for parole, Doug.
ABC's Aaron Kutursky live from Bellefonte, Pennsylvania again. Jerry Sandusky, the former Penn State assistant football coach, sentenced 30 to 60 years in prison. I'm Doug Limerick, ABC News.
The Truman Show now continues on the voice of Rutherford County, WGNS, AM and FM.
And welcome back with Greg Tucker, and this part of his show is brought to you by At Home Care. And when you and your family members need assistance for a day, a week, or indefinitely, At Home Care is ready to sit down with you and help devise a practical plan to meet your family's needs. At Home Care is different than any others you see in the local marketplace because they're owned and operated by longtime Murfreesboro resident Melissa Warren. That means At Home Care is hands-on and involved in your family members' care and satisfaction all day, every day. At Home Care provides top-quality professional caregiving services throughout Rutherford County and Middle Tennessee. Whether you need a 24/7 companion, ongoing assistance with transportation to church or doctor's appointments, laundry, housekeeping, personal care, or more, At Home Care is here for you. At Home Care, 713-4639, online at homecaretennessee.com. That's 713-4639. At Home Care, your number one source for the best care in Middle Tennessee. You know, Greg, I think you're going to be back on with us next Tuesday because we're going to do
a memorial
for Dr. Leon Ruhlin that day.
I look forward to that. And let's conclude our discussion of the bicentennial, hopefully, mm-hmm. for another 25 or 50 years. with what
you
is.
You think we'll be here?
I plan to. I'll
be waiting on you.
One of the most often asked questions in connection with the birth of Murfreesboro, which is when and why did we decide to change the name of the spelling of the name?
That still bothers me.
It still. We never really explained why. I can see in the documentation that starting about 1840, 1845, there was some confusion about how to spell it. We actually see it done sometimes with an apostrophe and sometimes mm-hmm. with the UGH and sometimes without it. During the Civil War is when it disappeared, and I really blame it on the Reconstruction legislature, which, as you know, was very different from the population of the legislature before. Mm-hmm. Again, without explanation, all the legislation that came out of that Reconstruction period, 66, 67, 68, spelled it without the UGH. So mm-hmm. I always say the UGH died during the Civil War. The UGH died during the Civil War, and no one has ever found any explanation or any specific reference or any discussion. It just disappeared.
Well, a lot of people spell it M-B-O-R-O with an apostrophe there.
Yeah, and I hope that doesn't become the standard spelling.
You know, it's kind of interesting to me that one of the names that popped up for our town to be named would be Tuckertown. Now, that is one name that it still bothers me because it seems to be lost in our history.
Well, I can show you a sign that says Tuckertown Square.
Oh, really?
Out the Nashville Pike. Yeah, that was the first, if you're going towards Nashville from Murfreesboro, Tuckertown was where the first toll gate was. Mm-hmm. And William Tucker owned the store and had the little post office section of his store. Mm-hmm. And so he called it Tuckertown. That's what it was. And it's still there. Look on the left as you're going out the pike. It would have been a multiple of 5 miles from the Nashville base of the turnpike. But that's the old turnpike.
That's past the underpass going out?
No,
and then
just a little before the underpass.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I never see it out there as I go by.
The river and the railroad is right behind it. And it was William Tucker was one of the older veterans. He joined and was in the military while he was in his 40s. Mm-hmm. So by the 1880s, he was 80 some years old. It's William Tucker.
And no relation?
Maybe related.
You got to look back and see maybe there's some land still left out there somewhere.
You think we'd have a fractional claim to as a descendant, huh?
You know.
I was pleased. Someone built a little business square there, and they call it Tuckertown Square.
Do you remember going to the old square when you were a kid like I do?
Oh, I remember walking behind my granddaddy as it seemed like he knew everybody on the square. And, you know, I think everybody did know everybody.
That's the thing I remember. Other than the Princess Theater, I remember that there wasn't a soul walking around that square that you or your parents didn't know at that time.
Everybody knew everybody on a Saturday in the square, usually Saturday morning, was a very social time.
I miss that, don't you?
I do, too.
I know everybody out there that, in our era, they miss it. It's just something special. I hope that the kids these days have something very similar to that they can hang on to.
One real quick square story. I'm walking with my granddaddy a little behind him, and he stops and he talks to somebody, and I'm looking around, and I look up, and the policeman's writing a ticket on my granddaddy's car. And I go up to him, Dad Tucker. He says, "Now, child, I'm talking to this man. You just wait a minute." And I properly did. I stood there and watched him write the ticket. And when my granddaddy turned back to me, I said, "You got a ticket." And he walked over looking kind of upset, reached over and got the ticket, looked around the square, saw the policeman, walked over to him, called him by name, and said, "You've just ticketed my car." And the policeman said, "Oh, Mr. Tucker, I'm sorry about that. Give me that back."
the way things used to be.
The way they used to be.
All right. We'll see you in the morning at 9 o'clock, and we'll have Miss Carrie Boylan on, and she is one of the ladies that works up here at the radio station, and she speaks in a very different language. So we'll be talking to you in the morning at 9 o'clock.